This episode of 3GT is brought to you by the Westminster Conference. The Westminster Conference is sponsored by the Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary and will be held on September 8th through 9th at RPTS right here in Pittsburgh. For more information about the Westminster Conference, visit rpts.edu and look for the banner at the top of the page. There you can find information about the conference, including registration information. You can fill out our online form or mail in a form. Registration for our conference this year is $20 for an individual or $35 for a couple. The topic this year is Post Tenebras Lux, celebrating 500 years of Martin Luther's influence. The speakers will be discussing the theology of Martin Luther, as well as the very practical nature of the way he interacted with scripture and with theological matters. This year's conference will feature speakers from Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary, including Dr. William Van Dudewaard, along with his wife, Mrs. Rebecca Van Dudewaard. Some professors from RPTS will also be speaking, including adjunct professor Dr. John Bauer, Dr. Rick Gamble, Dr. C.J. Williams, and our own Barry York. We hope to see anyone who's in the Pittsburgh area in early September at the conference, and we thank the Westminster Conference for sponsoring this episode. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for information about how you can receive an anthology of all the past Westminster conferences on a 2-CD set or on digital download. More information after our show. Welcome to 3GT, a podcast where a pastor, parishioner, and professor have lively conversations on practical Christian living from a Reformed perspective. For more information, visit our website at 3GT.fm. Well, welcome back to another episode of 3GT. I'm Aaron Sams, and I'm joined with our usual crew here, Kyle Borg and Barry York. And today we're going to do two things. We're going to have a bit of a mailbag conversation. We're going to take a look at a few emails that a few of you have sent us and chat about those. And we're also going to do a bit of a rewind. We're going to revisit a few points that came up in our episode that we did a few months ago on abortion. This is based partly on an outside of the recording conversation that I had with Kyle and with Barry, and just a few things that we were chatting about offline that we decided to bring into the conversation. So we decided we'd revisit that. So to get started, however, I think Barry has a few emails that he received this week that we'd like to share with you all and chat about some things we talked about a few episodes ago. Barry, what do you got for us?
Well, first one was we heard from a listener from England, which I thought was fascinating enough, just that we have people across the ocean listening to the podcast. But what
I'm glad we don't have to pay for long distance internet. Isn't that great?
Yeah, this particular individual won one of our giveaways, and so I had to ask the sponsor if they were willing to ship there, which they fortunately was, at least for this particular prize. So I was grateful for that. But in corresponding with David, he says that he has been listening since the very first episode. And I thought, wow.
It's longer than I've been listening, that's for sure.
My Calvinism kicked in. The doctrine of perseverance here is certainly true if someone's been listening to us that long. I was reflecting back when we started our first couple of episodes. They were somewhat funny because we were just trying to figure out what we were going to do in many ways. We're talking about Austin being a mailman and our encounters with dogs.
And don't forget our 45 minutes of arguing about the length of a podcast.
Yes. Yeah, we spent a lot of time doing that. So hopefully we're learning, and we are certainly grateful for listeners like David who stuck with us this long. One of the things he says, I'm a relatively rare creature, an English Presbyterian. But he says, thankfully, we're no longer an endangered species. So we're glad that we can help out our English Presbyterian brothers and any others in England who are listening to us.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and thanks for your continued listenership. Obviously been listening longer than I have since I just came on not too long ago.
Yeah.
and endurance to you, David.
Yes, yes. If anybody else has been listening that long, we'd be glad to hear from you. We do have an email address, and if you can spell three guys theologizing all in one word, and then put @gmail.com, we'd love to hear from you. So send us an email and tell us anything you'd like about yourself, or if there are ways that we can improve, we'd be glad to hear that. I did just get a comment from a listener, and I realized that we have been leaving off a download button on our podcast, so we're going to work at rectifying that. We actually did not too long ago from this episode start doing that again. So our apologies for not making that easily available, but also a reminder that you can go to iTunes and look us up there and get your downloads done automatically if you subscribe to our podcast there.
So Barry, the download button that you're talking about, that's going to be on our website. Is that right?
Yes.
3GT.fm.
That's right. That's right. Under each episode, you can download that episode if you'd like. One other listener responded to our episode. I forget the number. Was it 30 on the Lord's Day? I should have that in front of me. I'm sorry I don't. But we did a podcast on the Lord's Day. Yeah, it was episode 30.
Episode 30, it was. Yeah.
And one of our listeners, Brennan, responded to that, just thanking us for it. But it was interesting. He gave a little bit of a testimony along with that. He's up in the Minnesota area. And as he was looking for a new job there, he said, "I told all my prospective employers up front that I was unable to work on Sunday. I felt like honesty up front was the best way to go. And I would also say that if working on Sunday was a requirement, then my plan was to look for some other job." And he just testifies that by God's grace, he almost always had positive responses from his employers regarding that. And he even sent me a little excerpt of an email when a situation arose in his current job where he was being asked to work on Sunday, but he respectfully responded how positive his boss was in relating back to him, just thanking him for his convictions regarding the matter and encouraging him on in that. The employer said, "I admire and support your faith and your commitment to being a Christian." So I think sometimes in these issues, we get so fearful that we just don't show honesty to even unbelievers, and we don't realize we're missing an opportunity to witness that our commitment to the fourth commandment gives us. So I just wanted to share that with you guys and with our listeners as a point of encouragement to you.
All right. Well, Barry, if that's all that you've got in the mailbag, I think I'd like to jump into our rewind to go back to our conversation about abortion. So since we aired that episode, a few things have happened in our country. There have been two major marches. There was the Women's March, which was largely a feminist driven event, I should say. And then there was also the March for Life, which was an anti-abortion, pro-life march, just to bring awareness and information and just public presence to those who are pro-life. And those things have kind of stirred, I think, the pot a little bit, brought the conversation to the forefront of more people's minds than maybe it often is. But something that kind of came up in our conversations offline was a distinction in two approaches to being pro-life, and one of which is an abolitionist approach, and one of which is an incrementalist approach. And these are actually kind of two terms that I didn't really have a good grasp of, and Kyle and Barry have been helpful to clarify these for me, but I kind of wanted to bring that conversation into the public forum here and to see if we could work to define those terms, guys, and perhaps take a look at some benefits and some potential drawbacks of either of those approaches when it comes to promoting life and seeking to end the practice of abortion. So let's start with the terminology. Kyle, what's meant by these terms, incrementalism and abolitionism?
Well, we can probably start with what I would regard as the easiest one, incrementalism. to do something incrementally, of course, just means that you're using many small changes instead of maybe a few extensively planned and large changes. And so an incrementalist, and this would not be specific to abortion, it would be, you could really apply it anywhere, but an incrementalist would be aiming at an end goal, but to accomplish that end goal would be taking little incremental steps in order to accomplish the big picture. And so that would be the incrementalist view, whereas the abolitionist view would be really foregoing some of those incremental changes and just doing the large, extensive change. So to bring it into the discussion of abortion, an incrementalist might look at the issue of abortion and with equal hatred say, you know, abortion is murder, it is wrong, but let's deal with the reality of the situation. We're not going to be able to change Roe versus Wade overnight. So what are some incremental steps we can begin to do to lessen abortion, to raise more awareness, to begin to direct the course of our political, social world to hopefully, in the end, meet this end goal of seeing abortion ended completely? The abolitionist would be, if you're familiar with Jeff Durbin, he has an extensive ministry, Abolish Abortion Now, would say we settle for nothing less than the end of abortion at this very moment. It needs to happen now, and we're not interested in little steps to try to sway public opinion. We're not interested in that. It needs to end, and it needs to end now. So that would be the difference between an incrementalist and what we're calling an abolitionist.
Okay, so what are some benefits to either of those approaches? So let's start with the positive side of either of those. What would be the benefit of taking either of those approaches as it pertains to ending abortion?
I think one of the things that we could see or say about that is that sort of what their targets are, the incrementalists often is trying to make changes, maybe we could say from the bottom up, where they're trying to engage the culture, individuals, people, work at local communities, the state, that type of thing. Whereas the abolitionists may have more in the idea of just let's get a constitutional amendment that calls each unborn child a person, and that will outlaw the thing throughout the whole of the land. And so one positive aspect would be, well, I think we need both. I mean, we want to see abortion ended. And so the fact that they're aiming at these targets that both need changing ultimately would be important.
I think without coming down yet on either side, so just trying to be as objective as possible and to parrot some of what Barry said, you know, one of the good aspects of an incrementalist approach is at least the well-intentioned goal is to make it more attainable. That if you begin putting certain measures in to try to change people's thinking, to try to limit abortions, et cetera, you might not be able to completely in a moment outlaw it, but it does seem to be more attainable. It seems more attainable than, as Barry mentioned, a constitutional amendment that needs all kinds of political loopholes and gymnastics to actually get through. And so the incrementalist, I think that's a good aspect of incrementalism, is it makes the goal perhaps a little more attainable one step at a time. The good side of the abolitionist is, in no uncertain terms, declaring this is not tolerable. And in one sense, it should not be tolerable that society kills the weakest among us. Mm-hmm. That there is a true horror to the murder of abortion. And the abolitionist has very good intentions to say, we cannot tolerate it, we cannot excuse it, we cannot put up with it. It's murder, and it needs to stop. So those would be the good that I'd see.
One other thing I might just add real quickly, Aaron, is
sure.
Probably both sides, if they're Christians that are holding to one or these positions, could probably find places in Scripture to support either approach. I mean, the incrementalists might look at the way the kingdom of God is described in the Bible as being like leaven, and it spreads, you know, throughout the whole of the loaf. so that you have to work with processes. And so they might use that as a biblical support or other thoughts along those lines. The abolitionists could point to certain times in the history of God's people where all of a sudden great reform came all at once. You think of life under King Hezekiah, for instance, who just got rid of all those altars where babies were being destroyed. And it seems like in the click of his fingers. And so it came very quickly. So I think you could find some biblical support for either one.
So let's take the other side of it then. What are some potential liabilities that either of those approaches might face? So, you know, those who are, you know, taking the all or nothing approach, or those who are trying to take the incremental approach, what are there pitfalls that either side could find along the way? Are there things that you might even caution people on either side against so as they're kind of working through this?
Seems like incrementalism, one of the pitfalls would be compromise, that because you're trying to work so hard at persuading and getting something across, there's a lot of give and take in an approach like that. And so you end up at times getting put into positions, if you're a politician or you're trying to work at some level in the school, and you're just trying to get something at least reduced, it still could look like you're compromising. Again, the other side would be that if you're an all or nothing person, you could seem to be pretty intolerant of other positions, and it might make you, it could easily cut you off from discussion and seeming reasonable to people that you're, whose minds you're trying to change.
So Barry, you mentioned when you were talking about the potential liability of an incrementalist is that someone might appear to be compromising. So the appearance of compromise and then an actual like sinful compromise are kind of two different things. So, you know, appearing to be compromising, you know, people, I think, who are operating in that capacity with a clear conscience and, you know, that are not doing something sinful, I don't think they probably care about that too much. But then on the other side of that, those of us who would probably lean a little more on that direction where we would like to take small steps to prevent people from wanting to attain an abortion, you know, what are some steps we could take ahead of time, you know, in terms of healthcare or education or you know, providing appropriate forms of contraception, you know, so where does the incrementalist not just have to worry about an appearance of compromise, but are there places where an incrementalist ought to be cautious of actually sinfully compromising?
I think, you know, people who talk about some of the culture wars will talk about having co-belligerents, people that you may disagree with in one area of theology or life, but you can cooperate with in some thing out in the world. So for instance, an example would be the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church have a great divide on the issue of justification by faith. And so in any interactions or ministries where I would be asked to speak, support anything that would go against justification by faith, I just, as a Protestant, I shouldn't do that, or I would be compromising my faith and not being true to the Lord. But in the area of pro-life, for instance, you often find Protestants and Catholics working together in society because with respect to the unborn, we basically believe the same thing, that life is a gift from God. And so you'll find some cooperation along Protestant Catholics in certain activities. However, even that has its limits at times. I know in my ministry, we were trying to work with the agency in town that was Catholic supported, helping single mothers, you know, those who were pregnant but out of wedlock. But we began to realize that some of the counseling that was taking place to these young women really wasn't gospel-centered. And so we had to back away from some of that. Fortunately, another ministry came in that we felt more that we could support wholeheartedly. So those are the kinds of issues I think you have to wrestle with as you engage in trying to bring these changes.
Kyle, any cautions or potential areas of compromise that you could see by taking the incrementalist approach?
I guess my caution with the incrementalist approach would be, and I appreciate the intents, and you know, maybe I can speak somewhat objectively because I don't know that I'm 100% committed on either side, but the incrementalist approach seems to, at least to me, to presuppose a certain idea of progress. And while I appreciate the intent and the motives for an incrementalism on an issue like this, I think, call it my pessimism with society and politics and human nature, I just don't see that we're always moving forward. And that the incrementalist, I think one of the dangers is you take two steps forward, well, you're likely to take one step back. And so no matter how many little incremental changes you're aiming to take, the question is, are you ever actually going to achieve the goal? Because in one sense, even the incrementalist should say, nothing short of a total ban on abortion should be, at the end of the day, sufficient. I you know, and I maybe an incrementalist could correct me on that, but the incrementalist wants that, and that's what they're aiming at. And I guess the question is, will taking small steps actually ever yield that result? Or is it going to be two steps forward, one step back, or two steps forward, three steps back? And are you ever actually then, at the end of the day, going to achieve what you want to achieve?
So one other aspect of this conversation is, and we talked a little bit about this on our first episode, but I'd like to tease this out a little bit more, is one of the criticisms that one of the criticisms that pro-choice people look at pro-lifers and say, you know, you say you're pro-life, but you're really seem more pro-fetus than you are pro-life. So what are the pro-lifers doing? First of all, how are you defining pro-life? Is it just you're against abortion? Or is this a pro-sanctity of all life? And what is being done other than just simply trying to abolish abortion to help people thrive in the world, to prevent unjust and unnecessary death, to ensure that life is that the sanctity of life is protected from conception till death? What are some things that are going on that those of us who hear that as a criticism can use to respond to that type of criticism?
Well, I think if I can jump in first, there's a part of me where I want to be very fair and say that's a very fair criticism. I've often wondered, you know, becoming a pastor, I guess, has forced me to look at things in a different perspective. I've never gone and picketed an abortion clinic, primarily because there's not an abortion clinic in my county, and my first calling is here, and so I don't see any need to extend myself beyond that at this moment. But, you know, I wonder at times if those who picket abortion clinics, you know, if you get the woman to turn around and say, I'm not going to kill my baby, do they pat her on the back and send her on her way? Or do they begin to deal with the very real situations that she is facing? And I don't mean to make her and somebody who would abort their baby a victim. I don't mean to even be sympathetic with the idea that you can kill a baby. But there are real situations and real struggles that lead some women to an abortion clinic. And is the church going to step up in an act of mercy and give a cup of cold water to that woman? Are we going to only be content by saying, don't kill the child in your womb, but now you're on your own? I think mercy demands that we do more and extend more and do what we can with the resources the Lord has given us to go beyond that. So I think it's a fair criticism. At the same time, I want to be very cautious because it might be a blind criticism. I remember reading an interview recently with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, probably a guy I wouldn't agree on most things with. And I forget the exact language that the interviewer was using, But he talked about, it wasn't in a direct relationship to this question, but he was really being critical of the church, that, you know, is the church really just all about words and not deeds? And I remember Justin Welby in his English idioms basically said, that's hogwash. It is absolutely ignorant to think that the church of today is only about words and not about deeds. And he began from the top of his head listing off the statistics of what the church is actually doing in being merciful and doing humanitarian work. You know, you think in our own culture about the food pantries and the clinics and the provisions that are made and the soup kitchens and whatever it is, so much of that really is built either by the church or parachurch organizations or Christians who feel a desire to love their neighbor as themselves. And so I want to be fair and say, is there some validity to that criticism? There could be, but I also would want to say, but the church is doing a lot in our society.
Yeah, I think the fact of just this whole rise in adoption agencies, and there's just a list that's long out there waiting for children to be adopted, and they can't supply all the children. Again, partly because our society is putting them to death before they see the light of day. So I really agree with what Kyle's saying, that there is, again, the church has failings and weaknesses, and we're not all as sensitive as we should be to some of these matters, but generally speaking, the church has been trying to meet these needs and help people see that there really is a true alternative to ending a child's life.
So I don't want to politicize this question, and so you're welcome to dodge if you want, but so, you know, we've talked about the responsibility the church has. Kyle, you mentioned, you know, if the picketers out there turning a woman away from an abortion clinic, you know, are they going to offer then to help her with what she needs to bring the pregnancy to term and, you know, raise a child that she clearly has sought out to terminate prior to that. So, you know, this is partly a church conversation. It's partly a political conversation. And the goal is obviously to eliminate abortion on the level of an enacted law. So what responsibility then does the church or the state have if the state were to say, okay, abortions are now illegal? Does that then place the state some responsibility on the state to then help women who would otherwise have wanted one to be able to, in terms of like, you know, providing health care to bring the child to term or providing any sort of service there? Or is that simply like, that's just out of the question? That should be the responsibility of the individuals. Should the church step in? I know that's a complicated question, but it's all part of the same conversation, is like, whose responsibility is it if there is an increase of children being born out of the bounds of marriage, increased number of children being born that would have otherwise been aborted?
Well, maybe this is where I tip my hand a little bit. I my goal is to see abortion outlawed, and so in that sense, I'm an abolitionist. But I think we have to do everything we can to take any positive step that we can. And we live in an imperfect world. And so when we come to these kinds of questions, we have to really think about, yeah, in a perfect world, it might work this way, but what about the situation we're in? We're in a nation where for over four decades, we've allowed for the killing of unborn children. If God ever was to bring our nation to a point where we realize this is wrong and we actually overturn it, I think our nation would have a responsibility at that point in time to do whatever it could to support the life that, in terms of repenting from what we've done, and support the life that's there. So in an ideal world, I think, you know, unwanted pregnancies and things should be handled on a familial or church level. But in a society where this thing's been going on for so long, if the government were to step in and get involved, I think I'd be thanking the Lord that they're wanting to, you know, they're wanting to help, even though I lean a little bit more towards in family type issues, children issues, that the primary line of responsibility has to be, you know, the family itself and the church and the community.
I want to be careful just to preface this with, I agree with the Westminster Confession of Faith that the church is to determine nothing but that which is ecclesiastical in nature. So balance what I might say here with the fact that I'm not necessarily speaking as a pastor, but as a citizen of the country. I agree with Barry. If the nation were to step in and do that in order to save children's lives, that's something I would be happy about. Part of this gets into our own views of politics and the civil magistrate. And the civil magistrate is to protect life. Mm-hmm. That is one of the most fundamental, basic principles of civil government, is the protection of life. And they are to do in as much as they can to promote life as well. But it also needs to be borne in mind that the Lord asks us to be stewards, whether you're the civil magistrate or whether you're the church or just an individual. The Lord asks us to be good stewards with what he's given us. He doesn't ask us to be good stewards with what he hasn't given us. And the reality is, in today's society, the state and the church may not have all the resources at their dispense to do what maybe some of us want to do sometimes. And I don't think we can fault us. We need to show mercy. I think the government, to a degree, has a responsibility to show mercy. Nebuchadnezzar was brought into judgment because he refused to show mercy to the oppressed as king. But I also don't want to then jump to the conclusion that therefore they're the prime responsibility. The primary responsibility is the individual. And there's a fail-safe way to not have an unwanted pregnancy. And biblically, there are degrees of responsibility. And so in saying that, I think the church should extend itself to show mercy in as far as it can with the resources that the Lord has given it, that the civil government should extend a degree of mercy with the resources that it has been given. I'm all for that. But at the end of the day, I don't think the primary responsibility is on their shoulders.
Well, guys, this is, I found this to be a really helpful conversation, because I think what it's exposing is just a lot of the complexities of the conversation that are often, left out of the broader picture and conversation. We're talking about, you know, burden of responsibility. We're talking about, you know, the job of the state and the function of the church and its members. And I mean, these really, I would say, really nuanced ethical implications of, okay, if this particular action becomes illegal, there are other things that need to be considered. And if the action of abortion remains legal, there are still complex issues that need to be considered. And we simply can't make it a I'm pro-life or I'm pro-choice conversation, that there's a lot of nuanced stuff that we really have to tease out and think carefully about, and to wrestle through and to pray over. And those are the kinds of conversations I hope come out of this, because it's not as simplistic of an issue as I think it's often publicized to be, or, you know, picketed to be. So I appreciate the way you guys have handled the nuance of the conversation.
But
go ahead, Kyle.
I was just gonna say, despite those complexities, I think we should never let those complexities obfuscate the fact that abortion is murder. And I think you both would agree with that there are complex questions, and we need to wrestle with them, and we need to seek honest answers, and we need to have dialogue. And on some of those questions and answers, we could probably agree to disagree, but those complexities cannot disguise the fact that abortion is murder, and it is something for which men and women will stand in judgment.
I think another thing that ties in here, is fundamental to it. I reflect on Wilberforce's work in England to, you know, eventually get the outlawing of the practice of slavery, and that, you know, he did so many different things over a course of a long period of time in order to sometimes even trick Parliament itself to vote on something that would end up taking away a measure of the slave trade. And so I would see Wilberforce was an incrementalist who ultimately saw more toward the end of his life what he had been working for all those years. But one of the things that he really emphasized was also the contribution of the church in his day to this problem in society. And he really spoke against the liberal form of Christianity that was being practiced and saw that as part of the problem. And so he not only worked in the political side of things, but he was also very desirous to see reinvigorated Christianity, which I think was what ultimately led to the change there. And I think that's one of the things we have to be careful in this, is to take any of these great social issues of our day. We can't lose sight of the gospel. That's the only thing ultimately that's going to transform people. It's ultimately seeing Christ that's going to help them to begin to value human life like they should, from the womb to the lowliest in our land. And so we've got to keep really making that our the central core of our work in the church, is bringing the gospel to people. And yes, along with that, then addressing issues like abortion.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for this revisit to this complex conversation. My hunch is that we will need to come back and revisit it again as conversations do develop, as things happen in our country, and I look forward to that time. But for now, this has been another episode of 3GT. We would encourage you to find us on our website at 3GT.fm. You can find us on iTunes and check us out on Twitter and also on Facebook. You should be able to find links to those on our website at 3GT.fm. We'll catch you on the next episode. If you'd like to receive the anthology of the past Westminster conferences, be one of the first two people to retweet this episode on Twitter. We'll look for those people, we'll contact you through direct message to get your contact information, and we will send you either two CDs or a link to digital downloads of the past Westminster conferences. Again, we thank the Westminster Conference for sponsoring this episode, and thank you to RPTS for hosting the Westminster Conference. More information about the conference can be found at rpts.edu.